So World War I is what, of course, gave birth to the Bolshevik Revolution and the and this fleshing out of Marxism as a revolutionary doctrine into Leninism as a mechanism. So there wasn't much option until World War I, and that was then the point where violent revolution became a commonplace idea. And the question then was, do you use the Leninist revolutionary techniques or some other techniques, for example, or anybody else's revolutionary, the French revolutionary technique, and so on. Until World War II, the nationalists, as we call them, and I think I talked about this earlier, this is not a pejorative term, it's simply the term you use in Vietnam to describe these two revolutionary roads or two revolutionary streams of thought, the communists or the nationalists. And it's not a question of whether nationalism was exclusive to one or the other, because it wasn't. And until World War II, the nationalists were stronger and they were more numerous than the communists, but they were not as well led, and they did not possess the kind of clear strategy which is represented by Leninism. These young organizers, many of them trained in China, slipped into the villages of Vietnam. They came to organize so as to motivate, so as to mobilize. Always, of course, they were regarded with natural suspicion by the villagers, which they afforded to all strangers. And very often they were betrayed by the villagers. Their messages, beyond anti-colonialism and kind of xenophobia, were basically alien to the Vietnamese villager, both in form and content. But with Leninism, what really counts is organization. It counts far more than ideology. Well, the distorted political process in Vietnam at this time greatly facilitated this process. It was a kind of semi-paranoid political environment in which all Vietnamese revolutionaries of all stripes found local conditions very almost ideal for advancing their cause. Say a little about getting into about the 1930s and about the Marxist-Leninist, the Stalinist relations with the outside world, particularly with the Soviet Union. The best way is to approach this sort of from the Soviet view. Stalin did not have the kind of messianic impulse that earlier Bolshevik figures did, such as Trotsky and a whole host of them. And he wasn't, and Lenin was much more committed to an anti-colonial and anti-colonialism as a kind of engine to drive the revolution in Asia than was Stalin. The Bolsheviks had bad experiences on this. They had the debacle in China, the so-called Shanghai Commune experiment, which helped to shape this negative attitude. But more than this, I think Stalin particularly regarded anti-colonial activities in any colony around the world as being a kind of useful but a rather undependable weapon against the capitalist world. Because he said all too often the progression in the revolution is that things go awry. Stage one, ousting the colonials, followed by stage two, temporary installation of a bourgeois, nationalist, communist, united front, and then the revolution stalls. And stage three, the communist takeover, gets sidetracked as the new colonial regime turns anti-communist. And further, Stalin was very continentally oriented. He was committed to the Soviet Union as the heartland. It wasn't until Khrushchev's advent that he was able to leap over this kind of continental mentality. In the 1930s, the Comintern was an organization of communist organizations around the world. It was a it was supposedly had no homeland. It was simply the headquarters for all the communist parties, communist governments, communist movements around the world. Under Stalin, it became more or less an instrument of the Soviet foreign policy. So it's kind of hard to try to establish the relationship of the Comintern and how much control it really had over the Vietnamese Communist Party. It's almost impossible to find any order ever going out to Ho Chi Minh that he didn't want to get. I mean, I can find no evidence of him ever doing anything that he didn't want to do, simply because the Comintern told him to. Possible exception was when they started the Vietnamese Communist Party in 1930, the Comintern said, we won't admit you unless you change the name to the Indochinese Communist Party. So they debated this for a whole year and then finally agreed to go along with it. It's the only case, I think, of a clear case where there was some instruction that Ho was very good at getting only the kind of instructions he wanted to get, and somehow avoided. This was became very true in the middle of the 1930s, when the United Front was being formed around the world by Moscow. All organizations were being encouraged to join this United Front in order to stop Hitler. It was called the General Front, the United Front. Now, if you were a Marxist, a Communist Party member in Paris, a Frenchman, this order probably made good sense. Hitler was clearly a danger, and so all of us ought to get together on the same, who, even though we don't like each other, don't trust each other, we should agree to join for this single limited purpose, which was to stop Hitler. Once he stopped, then we'll go back to business as usual. Made good sense in Paris. But if you were a Vietnamese revolutionary out in Indochina, and you heard that French were in trouble, the government was in trouble, you know, what better time to move against them? You know, instead, out comes the orders from the Comintern to the French Communist Party, which had administrative control over the Indochinese Communist Party, in effect saying, don't do anything against the Colon, you know, in fact, go to bed with the Colon, because this is in the name of stopping Hitler. And as I say, it probably made sense if you were in Paris, but it certainly didn't make sense out in Saigon or in Vietnam. Well, Ho Chi Minh, who recognized a sticky wicket when he saw one, vanished from sight, and he left it to others to defend the party line against the nationalists. Nationalists were saying, now we got these guys on the ropes, particularly when World War II was looming, we can kill off colonialism very quickly. But as I say, Ho simply vanished. Good clandestine leader. That's exactly the way a good clandestine leader behaves. You don't know where he was. But no other world figure can we say we don't know where the guy was for 10 years. Still don't know for sure. He was wild stories. He was in Stalin's jail, or he was in the caves of Yunnan with Mao Zedong. We still don't know where he was. Anyway, it put the Indochinese Communist Party into a kind of Russian straitjacket, as the nationalists kept pointing out, and they made it through the decade as best they could. But the Communist Party in the 1930s never really was what you could call highly influential. French Indochinese population consisted overwhelmingly of people who were politically apathetic. There were probably, the politically conscious, that probably didn't number more than 10% at the most. And they were divided into camps and into factions. Some had ostensibly made peace with France and sought to milk French communism in a kind of hidden hatred and contempt. Many intellectuals were in this group. Some were non-communist nationalists, or both militant and non-militant. And within, and then some were the Marxist, or various brands of communist revolutionaries. And then there were those who were politically conscious but never committed themselves. These are the famed attentistes, or fence-sitters. Probably they outnumbered the 10% who were politically conscious. Probably 5 or 6% of them were fence-sitters, attentistes. They didn't join any of the revolutionary movements. So the point is the Vietnamese Indo-Chinese Communist Party was a minority of minorities. Could mount a few demonstrations, create a few disturbances, but it was the nationalists that were out doing the real damage. They were the ones that were assassinating French province chiefs and sabotaging French colonialism as best they could. Well, all of this meant that by the end of World War II, the precondition in Vietnam was a virtual invitation to warfare. First to the Vietnam War, or Viet Minh War, which began about 1945, and then the Viet lasted roughly 10 years, and then the Vietnam War, which began in about 1959. Just to try to take this organizational malaise up a little further, the government in South Vietnam, as you know, was country was divided, and we'll come to this next time, to the Geneva Conference, which ended the Viet Minh War and the outcome of the Viet Minh War and the Geneva Conference that dealt with the Viet Minh War is what we'll deal with next time. But just to skip ahead to follow this trend of social malaise and disorganization, chaos, through past this point. In 1955, when the two Vietnams divided and the French left in 1955, French bureaucrats who had managed the South held all these key positions, simply packed up their bags and left. Took all the French engineers out of the coal mines, took French technicians with them. Some stayed, but not very many. They just left a kind of vacuum. In the countryside particularly, there was little other government. There had been the traditional village councils. These tended to reform. In so many years, the French had emasculated most of the non-governmental institutions on the grounds that they were anti-French, which they were. Thus, when Ngo Dinh Diem took over in a presidential or in a referendum on October 23rd, 1955, it was a vote, nationwide vote in South Vietnam. Do you want Bao Dai, the emperor, to continue on, or do you want Ngo Dinh Diem? And it was 95% Diem. Election might have been rigged a little, but I don't think it was rigged enough to make any difference. Diem took over. He took over and is just about a total a governmental vacuum as it's possible in a society. Government lacked organizational skills at the top, administrative skills at the middle ranks, and a system for recruitment at the bottom. There was no authentic village government. The village chief was an appointed official, in effect a civil servant on the district chief's payroll. He had been French, now he was Vietnamese. But he was not elected, and he was chosen by oftentimes fairly corrupt political means. There was no sound judicial base. This is probably one of the worst heritages of the French. They maintained what they called a multi-court system, one Vietnamese and one national. Go to court, you not go to the same court, accused of the same crime. There was a different legal code, whether you were French or Vietnamese. You didn't go before the same judge. And worse than that, the courts tended to be venal. The legal system was something to be manipulated. The law consequently was without respect. That is quite different from other colonial efforts. The British in Malaysia installed a firm legal system, It was not government by whim, but it was government by law, a code based on the principle of rule of law. And they really installed it, and they stuck by it, and they enforced it. Never happened in Vietnam. I remember the first time I went to Singapore, talk about rule of law. in those days, the airport was right downtown, right near town. And when you left the airport, there was a main street out in front of it. You just walked out the front entrance, across the street into the cab ranks. And so several of us came out, and my wife and I were carrying our bags, and we're going like this, just way into Malta Lane Highway. There's a Malayan cop across the street. And he looks up, he sees we're trying to get across, so he just steps out in the street like this and holds up his arms, and all the cars stop. And we're just shocked by this. You know, to step out on the street in Saigon like that, or, you know, he'd been run over 40 times before he got his arms up. But, you know, this was a sort of simple case of rule of law. When the cop holds up his hands, cars stop. And all over Malaysia, cars stop when the police hold their arms. All over India, they stop. But not in Vietnam. I mean, there simply wasn't this tradition of, you know, the rule of law, that the law was something simply to be manipulated. Government by whim. Worst conditions, really, that you could take over. So when Zim took over in the late 50s, he began to develop this this government. He was hampered by inexperience on his own part, shortage of managers. He did win, and it did win some battles. He took on the Cao Dai and the Hoa Hao. These were enclave governments. They were sect governments. They had their own armies. And there was one point when Zim took over when he controlled about six blocks of downtown Saigon. And that was it. That's all of the country that he controlled. Then the army opted for him, and, you know, threw their support behind him and took on these sect armies in the so-called sect wars, mostly in the streets of Saigon, but also out in the boondocks, and broke the back of them and began then to extend a government presence out throughout the countryside. And this was a steady process. It was pretty much a one-way process, some ups and downs, but it pretty much went on until the beginning of the Vietnam War in 1959. There were still about five district-sized areas in South Vietnam, the old Viet Minh bases, that the government never got to, and never had anybody in there. But the whole point was that this was an uphill effort by Zim to simply establish government presence in the country. The people who clean the, you know, build the roads and collect the garbage and do the things that are necessary. Yes. That was General I've never heard this. It could well be that the CIA had a black bag of money. General V, I guess it was. But I think more likely, where could General V go? I mean, my guess is the Army just figured that this guy Zim looks like he might be able to pull this off. Got the backing of the Americans. They've got a lot of money to back the Cao Dai, or the Hoa Hao, which is a very contained enclave. That's a non-starter. I mean, I didn't want to run the country. They wouldn't have run it if you offered it to them. What they wanted was their own little enclave government out there in Tay Ninh. I don't think it was a hard decision for the army to make, and I think a lot of them had basic nationalist sentiments. They wanted the system to work.
And you second group you mentioned, Cao Dai.
Hoa Hao. These are what I'll just call undifferentiated organizations. That is, they are organizations, traditional organizations, which are interested in all aspects of their members' life, economic, political, cradle to grave, so on, as opposed to differentiated modern social organisms like PTAs or trade unions, which are only interested in some of your life. And they had a pretty good setup under the French. It was an impossible political situation. You can't have, you know, three or four governments running in the same geographic area. Had to be one winner. Yes. I guess I shouldn't have jumped ahead this much. That's what the Viet Minh War was all about, and Ho Chi Minh won the war. But out of the Geneva agreements, he got the North, the DRV became the government there, GVN became the government in the South. I'll go into all of this in great detail. Right, they divided Vietnam, right. It was divided three-way, now it was divided twice, two-way. That's why we'll get, there's a fairly complicated story to be told in what happened at Geneva. The paradox that the Viet Minh won the war and then lost the peace. I mean, logically, you might say, and I think Ho Chi Minh was saying, Lê Duẩn was certainly saying around Hanoi at the time, I know journalists had talked to him, saying, we won the war, why are we giving this away now? But the essential reason is that he was sold out by the Chinese and the Soviets for their own reasons. Everybody sells out the Vietnamese. But we don't really want to get into the only way to deal with the Viet Minh War and the Geneva Agreements is to go through it kind of logically, not back into it. Yeah. There are also Chinese, ethnic Chinese from Vietnam, but Cambodia though was a monarchy, and the monarchy was retained, and the French operated a viceroy system, as they did say in Annam, operating through the emperor. I think they brought in Vietnamese technicians and specialists as they needed them, but. I don't know the extent of this. My general feeling is that Cambodia was pretty much, and Laos even more so, a kind of a real backwater in terms of anything happening. And there was no particular effort in economic development in either of these countries as there was. It was just sort of leave it alone, kind of a buffer state. That's demonstrable in terms of construction work, miles of road built, miles of canals. Much more was done, wasn't all that much, but in Vietnam, but still compared to Cambodia and Laos, as far as I tell, the French never put a dime into Laos for anything. And apparently didn't, see any need to it. There was not, they didn't take the attitude of exploitation with Laos and Cambodia as they did in Vietnam. I think probably it's a case of the French felt that we have to control Laos because if we don't, the Thais will, and we don't want that. So they just sat there. Yes. I don't think it was all that. Yeah, I think it's largely a myth of how unified the Northerners were too. We didn't see the disunity. We are seeing it today. There was some difference. The thing is that Ho Chi Minh took over in 1945, in effect. He set up a government. He was fighting the French, but so he was about a generation ahead of Ngo Dinh Diem in dealing with this problem of unity and divisiveness. And I think he also handled it much better. But essentially the problem both he and Ho and Diem faced was the same. It's just that Ho worked on it for 20 years more than Diem did, and he had a lot more things going for him at the time. He didn't have he wasn't fighting a guerrilla war, for example. And so, but I don't think that there is any demonstrable differences in terms of these historical influences between North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese in this sense. I'm not dogmatic about it. I mean, if you can show me evidence to the contrary, I welcome it. But I think it's largely a myth that that the North had their act together and they never made any mistakes and they did everything right, and the South, they could never do anything right. It's just a question of where you stood. And you talk to Northerners who lived through the war in the North, as I've done, at great length, you know, in large interviews, and they tell you endless stories of corruption and screw-ups and snafus and so on. So, dramatic. Yes. I think the clandestinism as a technique, as a means of political activity, was much older. I mean, it's the way they used it against the Chinese, and so for 800 years. So it was a well-installed system by the time the French arrived. I fought the French mostly for not introducing participational political activity. They tried this in some extent. They had a city council in Saigon, for example, that I think half the people were supposed to be elected. But it was the least kind of advisory committee. What they should have done is let them elect a genuine advisory committee and then take the advice sometimes. I mean, you know, when you can afford to. But mostly you have to build up the idea that that there's a political behavior requires an assumption of responsibility, and that it takes experience and it takes practice. And but mostly in the case of the French, it was just walking away from it. You know, when the British left India, Lord Mountbatten had these calendars published. I think it was 18 months before the independence, and these are huge calendars of one day each. And it was a regular calendar, but it also underneath had 180 days till independence, 179, 170, and all over India, in post office and so on. Everywhere you went, you saw these stupid calendars, 99 days, 98 days, and it creates a kind of consciousness that, you know, we're going to have to take over this and run this country ourselves. And so the transition in India was fairly smooth. But the point is that the British really made an effort to do this, and the French never did. The Dutch did something of this. The Americans and the Philippines the same way. We were talking about independence 10 years before, in 1935, 10 years. And so 1945, of course, was the middle of World War II, but we stuck to it even so. The whole notion of the tutorial responsibility that you have in trying to lead somebody into self-government. Well, we'll go into the reasons the French did this at least next time.